Welcome back. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. On our way to our conversation with Elizabeth Embry, who's running to become the next mayor of Baltimore, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. In our continuing conversations with those who would like to be our mayor, we are about to have a conversation with Elizabeth Embry, formerly with the state's attorney's office and the attorney general's office, who's taken leave of absence to run for mayor, announced in front of her alma mater, City College, and joins us here in the studio. Elizabeth, welcome. Good to have you in the studio. Welcome.
Mark, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor. I've listened for many, many, many years to you and your show, and it's both of its incarnations, so it's a pleasure to be here.
Good to see you. Folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can email us, as I just said, talk@steinershow.org, tweet me at Mark Steiner, but do call in, 410-319-8888, your questions for Elizabeth Embry, because as I say in all these recently, this really is anybody's race, given the voter turnout in the city. So all people hearing, one of them will be your next mayor, our next mayor. So let's just begin. This is one of the first things I thought as you were running, and it's a tough question, but I just want to throw it out and put it out there at the very top, all right? You worked for Bernstein. You were in his office for 3 years?
4 years.
4 years. And part of what defeated Bernstein was the anger and angst of many people in the city, but especially in the black community, of how he ran his office, how he was perceived to have run his office, of not indicting police officers, of not being clear, people thought, and forthcoming in the deaths of Mr. West and Mr. Anderson and more. And so you're associated with that office. So how do you respond to that one? That's part of a perception of his office and then of Elizabeth Embry.
Well, I would first say I am a career public servant, and I have worked for two state's attorneys. I've worked for two mayors. I've worked for the governor. I've worked now for the attorney general. And that has been – I've devoted my career to public service for the city of Baltimore. And I'm proud of my roles in, across the board, including mm-hmm. as deputy state's attorney in Baltimore City. And I'm very proud of the work we did there. Working in partnership, we dropped violent crime to 40-year lows. We had homicides under 200 for the first time in almost 40 years. And just a year ago, we had 100 fewer deaths in the city. And that's 100 fewer children, mothers, fathers who were dead. So I'm very proud of that work in reducing violent crime. I'm also very proud of the fact that we did that at the same time that we cut arrests in half. And we diverted thousands of additional cases out of the system, nonviolent drug cases out of the system, into public health treatment and other service programs, and proving, as Baltimore has done, as other cities have done, that public safety does not demand mass incarceration and does not demand zero tolerance. So I'm very proud of that work. As a leader, you have to make very hard decisions. And in that office, we made hard decisions every day. And some of those decisions are around cases where people die at the hands of police. And they're really, really tough cases. And it was a focus of Greg Bernstein. He himself prosecuted cases against police officers. I, as a young prosecutor, handled cases against police officers. So I'm well aware of the challenges in bringing those cases and the special nature of those cases, but also how important it is. So I'm very proud of the work I did there and proud of the reductions in violence in the lives that we saved.
So I guess part of the object lesson here is a question of how an office like the mayor's or the state's attorney's relates to the communities in Baltimore. And I mean, that I think was part of the problem in Greg Bernstein's case when he was state's attorney. But it's also a real issue here in Baltimore now. We have a city that is 63% African American. And a very divided city by class and race in many ways. There are very few neighbors, I've said before, that are really interracial neighborhoods. Maybe one's over here near Northwood, and we have a couple others in the city, Windsor Hills and a few others, but there aren't a lot of neighborhoods that are really, really integrated by class, race, let alone class. So And you have to speak to that. I mean, you have to speak to communities that will go, well, then why should I vote for you? I mean, what are you going to, well, you know, why shouldn't we have a black leader?
Well, I've spent my life in the city. I was born and raised. I'm a product of the public schools, Baltimore City College. I will refrain from saying that it, or I won't refrain. It's one in the top 4% of public high schools in the country, and it's a representation of what the school system and what the city is capable of. There are many such examples, but that is one, and why I announced in front of City College. And City College was a place where I went to school with, learned from, and with students from all across the city, students who took three or four buses to get to city and woke up at, you know, 5 a.m. in the morning because
right.
it was so important to be at City College. And as much as I loved it, being with students who fought so hard to get there really made me appreciate it even more. I've worked in city government and state government my whole career, and I'm well aware of the way that race is part of the fabric of the city. I live in Better Waverly, a neighborhood not far from Morgan, and we have all the challenges that neighborhoods in this across the city face with crime and poverty and vacant houses and blight. But also, we have amazing residents who are doing tremendous things on their own and in partnership with other institutions to help the neighborhood and to be part of the solution. So I as I go across the city and talk to people, what I hear uniformly is that people want new leadership and they want someone who they can believe will actually be able to execute on the promises. And there's a lot of talk. We all know that. We've heard politicians talk.
For a long time.
For a long time. And talking is easy, but it's doing that's hard. And I have a track record of management and leadership in making the city safe and working on job force development and housing. And I bring a unique set of skills that is timed for this moment in Baltimore when we have to come together and move forward. And it's not just moving forward in traditional ways, but it's attacking the disparities in the city, racial and economic, that are so stark and starker in Baltimore than almost any other city in the country. And one of the touchstone numbers for me is the fact that a child born in Druid Hill in West Baltimore has a life expectancy 20 years less than a child born in Roland Park. And that is just such a dramatic number, and we should all be thinking about it every day. But as mayor, I will wake up every morning and spend all day focused on eliminating those disparities and reducing concentrations of poverty in the city.
So I'm going to come back to this question of eliminating the disparities and the question of poverty in the city, because I think it is probably in all its concomitant issues is the largest issue we face in the city. But let me ask a question first about – and folks, do join us, 410-319-8888, your chance to talk to Elizabeth Embry, who's seeking to become the next mayor of Baltimore. Write to us here at talk@standardshow.org. Want to hear your thoughts, 410-319-8888. One of the things we talked about in the last hour that came out of the Freddie Gray trial was, to me, what was glaring as kind of a huge contradiction. When both the former police colonel Longo, who's now police chief in another city, and Captain Justin Reynolds said that things like the police department's general orders are not actually orders that must be followed, but suggestions that officers can ignore. Or former Colonel Longo saying, this was all reported in the Baltimore Brew, that Officer Porter had a right to fear Gray, whose legs were shackled, whose hands were cuffed behind his back, would have not attacked or even threatened Porter. So there's part of what the next mayor is going to have to do is wrestle with how we change the way we police the city. And everybody knows that being a police officer is not an easy job, that there are bad guys out there with guns, and it's a very scary position to be in, as it is for people who have to live in communities with bad guys with guns. But the reality is something's wrong inside the police department when you can have testimony like that to defend why a police officer didn't follow procedure.
So I have seen over the course of my career in many ways the deep distrust between the community and the police, and it's distrust on both sides, which is a significant fact. And I have worked with victims and witnesses for years in cases and heard their stories and heard their distrust in the system and distrust of the police. And I've heard from police their feeling that the communities don't like them, don't want them there, don't trust them. But I also know in talking to both sides how fundamentally both sides are committed to wanting to do the right thing, that communities want police to be protectors and partners in their fight against crime and to make them safe. And the police, for the most part, with obviously bad actors who are a significant problem, for the most part, enter the profession wanting to be to work with communities and to make them safe. So I do think that fundamental fact is important in moving forward. But I also am not naive to the ways that that distrust plays out in our city. And we have to always remember that the police department is our department. We pay for it. It is ours. It is us.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be responsive to the needs of the community. So to the point of reform, there are some things that are obvious and important, like body cameras on every officer. But there's also changing the culture of the police department away from a hostile relationship with neighborhoods and towards a community partnership model, which I think the current commissioner is committed to. But, of course, it's how you do that. And that is obviously will be the top priority of the next mayor, whoever it is. And certainly I bring the experience to, and the knowledge of the systems and the knowledge of the problems so that I am uniquely skilled to actually implement and make a difference in that way.
One of the things that was said to me the last night by – I'm only not using his name because I don't know if I can or not. And I'll have to ask him permission. But he was a top official in an administration here, in a mayoral administration, and said that how hard it was to even begin to understand, to tackle, to change the culture of the police department no matter what you do. I interviewed Commissioner Bielefeld a dozen times or more during the time he was commissioner. He kept saying he was going to put people on the street and take them out of their cars. Well, it happened, but it didn't really happen. The idea now that we're looking at what these officers said at this trial about the rules, but we don't really have to follow them, and then we see the mayor and the police commissioner telling us that they are ready to arrest people stepping off the sidewalk or blocking traffic if there's a demonstration, and the school system putting out the notice that school kids can be suspended if they walk out of school and demonstrate. And it seems to be a real contradiction here between what are our priorities and how we're going to figure out how to make the city safe. I mean, how do you – if you're mayor, how do you parse that out? How do you deal with that? How do you change the nature of what our focus should be in terms of policing?
So part of it is acknowledging, which is starting to happen, that the war on drugs has been a failure, and that sending the police in as sort of a semi-militaristic force to go into neighborhoods and just eliminate drug dealing is a model that has failed. And we have to be focused with relentless urgency on violence in our communities. And that means building cases against violent organizations. It means focusing on illegal guns, loaded guns that are being carried around the city, and it means building smart, strong cases against this relatively small number of people who are driving violence in the city. It also means having effective interventions like Safe Streets, which is something the city has invested in and has been successful in this city and in other cities, and expanding that across the city and all the neighborhoods that need it. Interventions that are not law enforcement interventions, but community health-based interventions, which have been successful. In terms of changing the culture of the police department, one of the things to look at is changing the way we measure the performance of police officers. And we still – one of the key measures is the number of arrests that police officers make. And it's an easy thing to measure because you can count it and you know what it is, and it shows an activity that is done. And I understand why measures like that have been persistent for so long. But also we need to measure the impact of policing on neighborhoods, the impact – of certain techniques on whether crime goes down and the satisfaction of communities and the way policing is done. So mm-hmm. We have to look at how we incentivize police officers and how they do their job every day. And if sitting in their car is incentivized, then they'll do that. And so we have to figure out how to incentivize and lead so that they will be active in the community, out of their cars, engaging with neighbors. And that's how we measure, how we incentivize, and also how we train.
So folks, 410-319-8888. Let's go to the phones, get a thought here from our listeners and questions for Elizabeth Embry, who's running to become the next mayor of the city of Baltimore. 410-319-8888, I should say, as a Democrat. Right now there's only one Republican, I think, he's even announced any race. But let's go to line one. Clarence, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Steiner.
Good morning.
Good morning. Ms. Embry, let me throw something at you right quick. You know, there's an author by the name of Manly P. Hall. He said one time, I remember, man in his attempts to correct one evil should not engender 10 more. So let's flip that over. In our attempts to correct the evil of police brutality, and we have an entity there that stands in the way of any effort to correct that problem, such as the case with Freddie Gray when the mannerism in which he was handled really ultimately, in my mind, led to his death. You know, how do you address that issue where you would see to it that there is no entity that would stand with political power or anything else in the way of your seeing to it that a police officer or a group of police officers who do that kind of action are not prosecuted. Thank you, Mr. Steiner.
Interesting question, Clarence. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Clarence. I appreciate the question and the wise words you led in with. I would say that having worked for many years with police and with community members, the vast majority of police are fed up with and have the least tolerance for bad actors in the police department. So I wouldn't agree that there is an entity, if you mean the police department, blocking action. I think there is enormous desire among all the police officers who do a tremendous job and are honest and focused on public service to have effective interventions and effective accountability in the police department for those bad actors who are betraying the public's trust. So I think there is that urgency there, but carrying it out requires leadership and commitment and understanding of systems, not just rhetoric.
So a lot of people calling in, which is a good thing. I'm going to read something that came through the transcript today and on a way to kind of really focusing on the poverty in the city and what you do about it. Rose Tree Community Center, which I've been involved with for a long time, put out this release. This is to all the candidates who are running for mayor. And they point out that over one-third of the Maryland state prison population, 22,087 people, are comprised of residents of Baltimore City. 60% of Baltimore City residents are African American. Approximately half of the African American men between 17 and 30 are under some form of criminal justice supervision. Approximately one-third of them are on parole and probation. The rest are detained in city jail or incarcerated in the Maryland system, correctional system. And there's this big issue being fought out in the state legislature, which we'll be talking a great deal about, over the right of former felons to vote as soon as they come out of prison, not when they finish parole or probation. And so they are asking candidates, do they support the idea of holding town hall meetings with ex-felons, parolees, probationers in Baltimore City communities in which they live, where the people live, not where the mayor lives, and on whole town meetings with detainees in Baltimore City Jail with Baltimore City residents who are incarcerated around the state of Maryland and those institutions to begin to change the nature of what happens to our communities. What do you think about that idea?
Well, Clayton Guyton is a hero of mine, and I will go to anywhere he invites me.
And he's a dear friend of mine, so I love Clayton, yes.
So absolutely. And I've done a lot of work around reentry, and in fact, one of my supporters is a man who I visited in prison because I'd read about the work he was doing as a mentor in the prison. He was serving a 33-year sentence, but he was serving as a mentor and doing amazing work within the prison, and now is out and also doing amazing work outside. So, yes, I've spent time in prisons, and I think that's an important place for politicians to go. And for people who want to be mayor of Baltimore, they should hear directly from the people inside the walls and outside the walls who are returning home, because it's affects so many of the lives of the people in the city. I think that's a tremendous suggestion, and I would love to be part of it.
I shouldn't have told you it was Clayton's idea.
But it's a good one. It's a good one. And I also just want to talk about for a second, because this leads into one of the things I want to talk about, which is doing things differently and spending money differently. And that's couldn't be more necessary than in the criminal justice system. And there's proven models of different ways of spending money. And one is the Safe and Sound effort, which is currently in negotiations or being discontinued by the state. But this model of spending public dollars on how to get people out of prison and into jobs and reducing recidivism by putting people to work and giving them the services they need rather than keeping them behind bars. And that public safety compact model is something that's been used across the country and has been used successfully in Baltimore City and needs to be a way that we're approaching spending money in the city and across the state.
So how would you do that?
Well, I think we have a great model in Safe and Sound. They've proven
– which the governor is threatening to pull the funding
correct.
Or take it away from the – 452 people have gone through the program. I think I had the number right.
That roughly,
have
yep.
About,
yep.
And the recidivism rate is so ridiculously low
yes.
of men coming out of prison and women coming out of prison.
It is a success. Its
right.
metrics are – it's whether it saves money and whether – and by saving money, they save money by keeping people out of prison. Now, people who are in prison through the – if they're part of the program, they're released earlier. And then they receive intensive services focused primarily on jobs and housing, but whatever services are needed. And then the compact, the idea is that the state is contracted with this entity and will pay them the savings or a portion of the savings in terms of fewer days that they have to house house of people in prison, and it's been effective. Recidivism is lowered. It saves the state money. So it is, that is, the model exists. We need to replicate it in other arenas.
Let's go to the phones. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Michael is first caller up. Angela, you're the next. So if we have to go to break, stay with us. Angela, we're going to come right to your phone call after break. But let's go to Michael first. He's on the line a little bit longer. Michael, welcome. 410-319-8888. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Very well. Welcome.
You know, I'm not really a talker, but I had to wanted to voice my opinion.
Go ahead.
I'm not expecting to get really an answer from you, but I've purchased maybe 15, 16 houses here. I've spent well over $500,000 in the city, figuring that I would make a difference in, you know, fixing them up, doing what I'm supposed to do. But on the opposite side, I was just from the mayor's department or from the police department. I feel that law is law. If you're wrong, you're wrong. And I, for example, police department, if you go drive past North Avenue and Pennsylvania Avenue or at Lexington Market, which I mean, I'm not from here, so I don't know the history of it. But I do know that when you see how bad it looks, it's so hurtful. But it's hurtful to me because I spend so much money here. And you get nothing from the mayor's department, and you get nothing from the police department. Now, you may see a police at the corner of North Avenue and Pennsylvania Avenue, and, you know, I'd ask them. I mean, you see what's going on directly in your face. I mean, they will tell you. It's really nothing that we can do. We're outnumbered. It's nothing politically. That it's nothing. What can I do?
But what are you suggesting that you want to see them do? What's your question?
For this city, what I would love to see happen is, it's not about white or black. It is about law. You can't go to any other city. Well, you can in Chicago and Detroit, but
lots of cities.
Most cities. If you go to, there is law. The police, you know, they have a job to do. I mean, like, for
example. So are you suggesting they should arrest the people who are hanging around Lexington Market?
Not necessarily. Okay, if you'd have to be, okay, politically correct, the loitering laws. There are no loitering laws. You have trash everywhere. Everywhere. And they're allowed to, they almost operate off of impunity, and you're allowed to just stand around and do your dirt in front of, who are going to respect a police officer if he can't do his job?
Let me turn to Elizabeth Embry.
It's Michael, is that right?
Michael, yes.
Thank you, Michael, for the question. So first of all, I want to say thank you for coming to the city and rehabbing houses. That's so important. I mean, I'm sure you know the scale of the vacant housing problem, and so it's terrific to have people like you working on it. I bought a vacant house myself and rehabbed it, so I know how much work goes into it, and so my hat's off to you for that. One of the reasons I'm running for mayor is I have complete hope that we can make a difference, and I know we can. And providing basic services is the job of government, and we've not done very good work around that recently. And that's from responding to being an available partner for small businessmen and people who want to rehab houses and want to start businesses in the city and expand their businesses, and being a partner, being accessible, not getting in the way unnecessarily, building access to capital for businesses and homeowners and communities, empowering communities to grow and to build. And that is what city government fundamentally has to be. It's about picking up the trash, getting the potholes filled, and delivering services to the people who are paying for them through their tax dollars. And that's something that has to be that's the fundamental measure of whether a government is successful, is whether it's delivering services effectively to the people.
So we have to take a break right here. We're going to come back. I want to talk about potholes, but I want to talk about Lexington Market, and I want to talk about how we develop a city like Baltimore, different than we've been doing it from what we've been covering the last 20-some years here on the show. We're also going to come back to the phones at 410-319-8888. Angela and a different Michael, you both will be coming up as soon as we come back. Stay with us. Join us at 410-319-8888 as we talk with Elizabeth Embry, who's seeking to become the next mayor of Baltimore. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner here with Elizabeth Embry, who's running in the Democratic primary to be the next mayor of Baltimore. We're going to come to Angela. Hold on and come to your call. We'll come to your call right now. Let me just read this promo first, because I want to remind you to join me on January the 13th for the 13th annual Annapolis Summit at the Governor Calvert House on the opening day of the state legislature in Annapolis on January the 13th, 7 to 10 a.m. It's your chance to have your questions answered when we talk with Governor Larry Hogan, Senate President Mike Miller, and House Speaker Michael Bush. So save your seat. Go to thedailyrecord.com/Annapolis-summit, or you can contact Morgan Cook at 443-524-8181. That's 443-524-8181, or morgan.cook@thedailyrecord.com. The Annapolis Summit is sponsored by The Daily Record, the Maryland State Education Association, Stevenson University, Alexander and Cleaver, VPC, the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, and WEAA. So be part of the Annapolis Summit, 443-524-8181, and have the state leaders answer your questions. Okay, back to Elizabeth Embry. Let me go to the phone. I was going to jump into an idea, but in all deference to our listeners, let's go back to the phones first, 410-319-8888. Angela, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
My question is, right now there are a number of disturbing realities going on in the city, and our city is blanketed in anxiety right now. However, there are also good things that are going on in our city. The eyes of the world are on Baltimore. We're on BBC. We're on CNN. What I would like to know from Ms. Emery is, how would she begin to change the perception of Baltimore? Because this is rooted in our development for economics, for small business, for big business. That's my question.
Thank you. That's a great question.
Thank you, Angela.
Yeah, Angela, I appreciate it. So you make a great point. The eyes of the world are on us, and that means that we can tell our story. We have the ability to tell our story and be heard. And the fastest way to change perception is to change reality. And we have to focus on changing the story, both changing the story of Baltimore and the narrative of our future, but also telling the story of Baltimore, because the story of Baltimore is so much more than the challenges we face. It's stories of amazing schools, principals and teachers who are doing amazing things across the city, nonprofits, new businesses. I was just with the woman who's created the Impact Hub on North Avenue, this amazing incubator for small entrepreneurial, socially entrepreneurial businesses. So there's tremendous stories across the city, and we need to be telling them, but we also have to change the fundamental reality, which is changing the poverty, changing the disparity, changing the poor outcomes in our school system and our criminal justice system. And changing that narrative will change perception of Baltimore.
So let me get very specific about that. The former caller, Michael, tags into what Angela was saying. Michael talked about what he didn't like, but what he saw at Lexington Market. And Michael, we're coming to your call right after this, so stay with us. And others, join us at 410-319-8888 or write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. To me, the future of Lexington Market is pivotal and one of the linchpins in determining what this next mayor is going to do and how they're going to approach development. Right now, I have this Bromo Seltzer Arts District. Students that we worked with at UMBC did this entire series on it that we aired on the air. The question is, how do you develop an area like that from the Bromo Seltzer Arts District up to Lexington Market and the blocks around, and A, not displace poor working people who live there and shop there, create a Lexington Market that's for everybody and not just for the bourgeoisie, that people used to say back in the day.
That's funny.
that is not just for young people with money coming through the city. And what about all the people who do mill around, live around Lexington Market, who are underemployed, unemployed, some addicted, and some people just poor with very little things to do in the day, and so they're at Lexington Market. So you, Elizabeth Embry, is mayor. You have to take over this development. You have to ensure how it's going to be developed. How do you do that? How do you ensure mixed development that's not just for teachers and social workers to live, which they should have that as well as the wealthy newcomers, but the people who live there, the working class people of the city. How do you do that?
And there's overwhelming data that mixed income housing is ideal, that concentrations of poverty produce the worst possible outcomes for the children who grow up in those neighborhoods and the people who live in them. So that has to be the priority in development, is having affordable housing for all levels, low, middle, and of course market rate housing. That is the model that we want. And how you achieve that is being strategic and having a plan to achieve it and not being so desperate, you know, for the developer to come in and build the development that you're willing to abandon priorities like affordable housing, mixed-use developments, and mixed-income housing. Lexington Market is one of the treasures of the city, but it's been crippled by the sale of primarily prescription drugs, but also illegal narcotics in Lexington Market. And the city has tried for years to deal with that with some success. Usually the successes have come when there's been a multi-agency approach that's been both public health focused as well as law enforcement. So there has been success, but not a sustained focus. And it's a great example of how leadership in city government has an idea but does not follow through and does not show commitment over decades. So we've had successes in the city. Station North Arts District is one such success where we've had really a lot of youth-driven, artist-driven, creative class-driven development that has been with some tension, has not driven out too much of an extent the residents of the community. But we need to be conscious of that in our development plans and in making sure that we're protecting the residents who are in the neighborhoods now and making sure they're part of the planning going
so
forward.
How you do that? I mean, how do we get to a place where when we develop part of our community, whether it's Station North or whether it is this Roman Seltzer Arts District and that part of west side of town between MLK and over to Howard Street and north and south, that protects and involves, but the other part is gives jobs to the people who live there. I mean, that's part of the question that nobody's been able to come up with an answer. How we develop a city that takes care of all the citizens, not just a certain part of the city.
You know, I talked about this a little bit before, and I'm from Better Waverly, and there's definitely the feeling in my neighborhood that they are not part of the planning process, they are not a priority, that the city does not have plans for the economic growth of my community. And so I've talked about and will continue to talk about empowering communities so that they're part of a transparent process, that capital is put into communities so that small businesses have access to capital to grow, to expand and create more jobs, that neighbors have access to capital to rehab their own houses or rehab vacant houses in the neighborhood. And that's been done in the 70s. One of the successful programs in housing has been the homesteading program, where the city issued low-interest bonds to fund loans for people to purchase and rehab vacant houses and for people who are middle and lower middle income families who could, so that they could afford to rehab houses. And it was a program that not only put people into houses and got houses rehab, but also made money for the city. And so that has to be part of the solution, is pushing capital into neighborhoods and having neighborhoods empowered so that they can be part of the planning process and part of the redevelopment process.
Let me go back phones here. We'll come back to this issue, and we are going to talk some more about the issue of poverty in the city and how the next mayor addresses it. 410-319-8888. Next callers are Michael and Sergeant Freeman. Let's go to Michael on line 3. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes. I'm a little fuzzy here.
Okay.
Over 30 years ago, I got out of the military, and I enrolled in Morgan. One of the required courses was race and public law, which was given by an individual from the state's attorney's office. He was a prosecutor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is it true that children led the civil rights movement after that young girl was bombed? They went out and protested, and their parents were sort of embarrassed, and they followed suit?
I'm not sure what you're asking, Michael, but, I mean, the... You're talking about the bombing that took place in Birmingham, Alabama in
1962? Yes.
As a matter of fact, just for a quick aside before we come back to this, is that one of our leaders of the city, Freeman Hrabowski, who's president of the University of Maryland Baltimore County's campus, was one of those children who was arrested in Birmingham, Alabama, that took to the streets when that happened. He knew those little girls, as a matter of fact, who were killed in that church. So it was always young people who led those movements in the South.
Okay, so what's happening here now? The children are taking a stand?
Yeah.
Okay. I was just a little fuzzy and a little curious.
Okay. Well, Michael, thanks so much. Appreciate it. Yeah.
All right.
Well, we're going to come. Actually, I do have a question about young people and activists in the city for Ms. Embry in just a moment. Let's go back to the phones first, though. 410-319-8888. Sergeant Freeman, you're on the air.
Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning, Sergeant.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm a retired staff sergeant, Air Force, Robert Freeman, United Veterans Coalition. And, sir, ma'am, I attended recently a meeting in regard to the unveiling of the and the meeting was the Market Center Merchants Association for the Lexington Market area, and the mayor was there and several city councilmen and so on and so forth. But there are plans, and I'm not trying to champion the mayor's, I think, think it was just basically a public appearance on her part because she had nothing to do with this actual committees being formulated. The Downtown Partnership was involved in this. But anyway, I mean, there are committees that are being established and it was well attended, and we have a lot of committees that are being set up, like Clean and Safe Committee, Marketing Committee, Community Development Committee, and Board Development. But one of the key issues that I brought up in this meeting was the fact that what do you do with those people, as you said. Now, gentrification, in my opinion, happens when you are developing areas and businesses and such, and it's also residential. But those people, in true gentrification, if you will, they don't live there. I mean, for the most part, so you're not really displacing the people who frequent there. Now, if the merchants themselves that have businesses there and they can't afford to be there anymore, they'll probably move on anyway because there will be new businesses coming in there and opportunities for employment and so forth and whatever. But for the most part, I believe, and they believe, they have to move whatever's in the forefront, that's in the back of their mind, to the forefront of their mind, as attacking or nipping it in the bud for the individuals that are down there to just go down there to get their swerve on, if you know what I mean. So what's going to happen from that is those people, if they don't address it, is going to move to Hopkins Plaza, is going to move over to Charles Center Park, is going to move to some other place where they know that they can go ahead and score whatever their activities are. And those are the things that really need to be addressed in the beginning through an educational program before the construction trucks move in. And that's what's really going to happen. And I would like for the candidate to address that, please.
Thank you. It's a very well-put question. I mean, you're absolutely right. Business cannot survive if it's surrounded by nuisance crimes, drug dealing, open-air drug dealing. And Lexington Market has long been... For a number of reasons that have to do with the confluence of bus routes and historical reasons, has been the center of illegal prescription drug selling. And when you walk to and through Lexington Market, there are people experiencing who are clearly high, who are clearly homeless and suffering from all of the related problems of addiction and homelessness. And so that is something that has to be dealt with, or business cannot succeed in Lexington Market. There's no question. And what I have seen over the years is when effective interventions have taken hold, it's when the city is actively engaged, and it's both law enforcement but also the public health sector and people going in with an intervention model to bring treatment, to bring people out into transitional housing, and to get them help so that they are not addicted and impoverished and hurting business in Lexington Market. So there have been strategies that have worked. What I've seen, the failure is a failure of commitment and follow through by the city. There's certainly commitment on the part of the Downtown Partnership and a lot of the community interest in that area.
So I'm going to come back to what part of the spirit of what we've been talking about here, and it has to do with not just Lexington Market. I'm going to walk away from Lexington Market for a moment because I don't want to get stuck here. That people argue, and I'm one of those people who says this, that half the city of Baltimore lives in poverty. Not 25%, that people like to throw the number out, but half. If there are 99,000 families who either are seeking public housing, in public housing, trying to find a place to live, who are home insecure, not sure what to pay first, many of those people who work for a living, 2-3 jobs just to make ends meet,
yes,
that live across the city of Baltimore in communities that are full of what we call abandominiums, everywhere, with people living in those abandoned houses and then going to jail because they're breaking the law by living in those houses, we have, and that in some ways is the criminalization of the poor in this city. And we see the tips and piles going off to people like Mr. Beattie and others in the East Harbor. And I'm not necessarily opposed to tips and pilots unless they pass one test. The test is, how does it affect the poor people in the city? And so if we're serious about our city, you have to talk about how we're going to redevelop it, what's going to happen in those communities. That's more important to me than Downtown Partnership or anything else, is what happens to the people of the city, half of whom live in poverty. So what does Mayor Embree's administration do?
You put it exactly right. The lens of every decision made in Baltimore City has to be through the lens of what is best for the city, and meaning what is best for reducing poverty in the city and addressing the disparities you're talking about. That has to be the lens of all decision making. And TIFs and pilots are not in and of themselves bad. They're useful tools. But the question is it the right project? And is the project being structured in a way that is doing the most for Baltimore City? And that means putting people in Baltimore City to work. It means putting construction jobs. It means the location of projects. It means whether it's the right numbers, whether the subsidies are the right numbers. And that means the city government has to have people who are smart and competent enough to really understand those projects and be able to push back and negotiate with developers appropriately to figure out what is the best number, what is the best subsidy, if appropriate at all, for the city. So I couldn't agree more. As mayor, I will focus on I will look at every issue through the lens of how is this reducing disparities and poverty in Baltimore City, and what's best for Baltimore from that perspective.
So I'm going to ask some specifics. I mean, so one is that we've had numerous shows, and there's been much written about the problems inside HABC and the Department of Housing and Community Development. The $150 million surplus, how that was spent. It can't fix all the problems, but it could have gone to ameliorate a lot of things for poor people in housing. It didn't. It went somewhere else. It went to pay off some debts and other things. So, and we have whatever the number is, 16, 30, 40,000. Nobody really seems to know the number of abandoned houses in the city for sure. But we know that they're extant across this town in the poor neighborhoods of our city. So you have to deal with housing as mayor. And with that crisis, I think the housing department's in.
One of the most critical issues in this city is accountability, and that is knowing what we are doing, knowing the numbers, knowing where the money is going, and that unfortunately is not true right now. The audit of the transportation department has just come out, and one of the key findings is the department doesn't even know how it's influencing or achieving its outcomes. It doesn't know what its outcomes are, and that is it is tragic. It's almost funny if it weren't so sad. And so the first step is making sure we as a city know how our money is being spent, and auditing is a big part of that. Having CityStat and other accountability systems is a big part of that. And the Housing Authority of Baltimore City has not been subject to that level of accountability or operational oversight, and it should be. Even though it's federally funded, the mayor should consider it an agency that she or he is responsible for and should have operational oversight and should be managing and assessing every day how many maintenance requests there are and how many have been completed, and all of the other metrics that should go along with that. And so as mayor, I will consider the Housing Authority and the functions of it to be something under my operational oversight, like the police department or the fire department or transportation, and knowing what's going on and measuring it and holding people accountable for getting their job done.
How do you have them use the money more effectively for poor people in housing in the city to ensure that people have housing? What would be – do you have a plan, a thought about how that would work?
Well, part of it is understanding and auditing how money is being spent currently, and that is something I am working on with my policy teams. I have some terrific people across the city working with me so that we understand. I certainly don't want to make any assertions or recommendations without knowing how we currently spend the money, and part of the problem is there's a very opaque budgeting process in the city, and understanding how money is spent is critical.
Folks, join us, 410-319-8888. Going to come to these calls coming in, 410-319-8888, as we talk with Elizabeth Embry, who's running to seek to become the next mayor of the city of Baltimore, 410-319-8888. Another tact here before we come back to the same question we're talking about, and I ask all the candidates this question. One of the things a mayor has to do is fix potholes in the city. Now, everywhere you drive in this town, you're in danger of destroying your car by going over potholes. It's not a minor issue. And I can't for the life of me figure out why all of a sudden we can't fix these things. And I did notice, and maybe I'm wrong about this, I don't mean to sound pejorative in the way I'm saying this, and you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, but, you know, I drive down down Asquith Street and other places to get to and fro and all through the city, and my car's always dodging potholes. But I'm not dodging them on Roland Avenue right now. But I am dodging them in the city. Something's wrong.
Right.
So what is it? What do you do about it?
Well, and I drive down Greenmount, and there's a new pothole every day, and I
right.
And the patching is sporadic. Although Roland Avenue is having its own problems. They've had, I don't know if you've heard about the crisis of the curbing. The city has wasted millions of dollars by failing to align the paving contract with the curbing contract, and so the city it's cost a couple $1 million just to fix that. The paving was higher than the curbing, and so there was flooding into people's houses. So there was a mess even on Roland Avenue. But I take your point about the way dollars are spent and looking systematically where is the greatest need in the city in terms of infrastructure and road improvements and following the need, not what a particular community wants. Absolutely. I grew up in the Schaefer era. That was my father was part of that administration, and I was a child during that time. And the one thing you knew was that you had a mayor who cared about all of the little things, the potholes being filled, the trash being picked up. And that's the kind of mayor I will be, bringing the urgency and the accountability to the small problems with city services, along with the big problems, too. But getting the small problems affects people's lives on a day-to-day basis and is critically important for what the city owes to its citizens and the citizens should expect from the city.
Let me go to the phones. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Let's go to line one. Elaine, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, Elaine.
Good morning.
I'm a product of Baltimore City Schools. I lived in Baltimore City from the age of 8 until 18, and I'm still a concerned former citizen. And I've listened for the past hour.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear information about the statistics, but I haven't heard the candidate actually outline any methods that she would use to improve things in the city. She basically is just repeating the question that the respondents have posed, but I haven't heard any concrete method. So can she speak to that?
So absolutely. So what I've talked about is providing safety to our neighborhoods and empowering our neighborhoods by providing capital to small businesses and homeowners, but also bringing jobs to the city in a sustained way. And that means going out and going to places like D.C. and talking to businesses that are paying three times the rent and saying, you should be in Baltimore. You can have the same access to D.C., but locate in Baltimore. You will save money. You will love this city. Connect those businesses to partners here. And be a salesperson and a cheerleader for the city, which is one of the key roles of being mayor. It also means connecting people in the city to jobs in the region. We have job growth in army bases, the ports, the defense industry, cyber industry, job growth across the region. But people in Baltimore have a hard time getting to those jobs because of our completely inadequate public transit system, because our school system and our community colleges do a poor job of aligning their curriculum and aligning their efforts to the jobs that exist and the jobs that are emerging in the future, and because people have criminal records with needs for expungement and the need for help clearing legal hurdles to employment. I will be focused single-mindedly on job development, creation and expansion in the city, and access to jobs both within and outside of the city by the people who live here. And that is what ultimately is going to make Baltimore the city that it is meant to be, that it is at its heart, and the city that we all love so much.
Folks, do join us. More questions, 410-319-8888. In the few minutes we have left, Gustavo, you're on the air. Welcome.
My question is regarding education.
Mm-hmm.
In the public school systems, we've noticed some closing of many Baltimore City schools. We've also noticed an increase of charter schools. And I wanted to get the candidate's decision on public school versus charter schools, and also in regards to in-state tuition for undocumented students who are paying taxes to the Maryland system, what is her knowledge or support or not support for in-state tuition for the Maryland Dreamers?
So I'll start with your first question. And I'm sorry, it's Gustavo?
Gustavo.
So in terms of the charter school issue, I think probably everyone on both sides would agree that litigation is a very sad place for us to be. It's a waste of resources. And I say that as a lawyer. It's a waste of resources, a waste of attention, and it's taking away efforts that should be dedicated to improving teaching in the classroom and the quality of education in our schools. So I think it could have been avoided. I think that the school system's lack of transparency in the way that discussions have been handled with the charter school representatives have been unfortunate, and I am confident that as mayor I can lead us out of that, the acrimony and the unnecessary hostility between the two sides, because ultimately what, what traditional public schools want and what charter schools want is the best education. They want support for what goes on in the classroom. They want to do the best. They want best practices replicated, and they want support from North Avenue in achieving that. And as I go around the city and talk to principals and teachers, my sister is a public school teacher at Tunbridge, which is a public charter school in Govins, I hear over and over again that North Avenue is an obstacle and not a source of support, and that dynamic has got to change. We have to be supporting our teachers and our principals, and actions by the government, by the school system, have got to be in support of quality education.
Let's try to get another. Can we have time for one quick call? Do we? Yes, no, yes. 410-319-8888, just one. Maria, very fast. We don't have much time. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well.
Good morning.
Very good. Mark, just so you know, this is Maria, who heard your show with Jar, and I contacted Jar, and I love him dearly. Okay, Candidate Empress.
Yes, ma'am.
You stated that your father worked under the Schaefer administration, and one of the things that I remember with William Donald Schaefer as the mayor is that he courted businesses, explained to them why they should come to Baltimore, went for the larger businesses, obviously, because that was a larger tax base.
Okay, Maria, we're almost out of time, so I have to let her answer a quick question.
The same, and if so, what companies are you looking at? Thank you.
Thank you, Maria.
Right, so what will make a difference in employment in Baltimore is having more Under Armours and having more large businesses that can employ lots and lots of people with different wage levels. So absolutely, that is a lesson from Mayor Schaefer and one that I have absorbed in my daily life under his administration, is that the mayor has to be aggressive. The mayor has to have a plan and go out and find the next Under Armour, the big businesses that will bring us the jobs we need to bring our communities and neighborhoods out of poverty and into productive communities.
We're done with
sorry.
A very quick question. So if people are interested in your campaign, how do they contact your campaign?
Thank you so much. So online, it's embryforbaltimore.org or .com. That's the best way to reach me. You can email through that website. You can sign up to volunteer, which we'd love. You can donate. You can do anything campaign related on that website. So please visit and join us on Twitter and social media as well. Thank
Elizabeth
you.
Elizabeth Emery, thanks so much. We'll talk to you again down the campaign trail. Good to have you here today.
Such a pleasure, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Reminding you all, the Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers is Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our interns is Sienna Greaves, Manifa Wilson, and Calvin Perry as well, who are both here today. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. Podcast the Mark Steiner Show. Share it with your friends. Visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.